I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein, and this is Spy Talk.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. Everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. With every move he makes, another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret agent man.
Ah, yes, Johnny Rivers with one of the great rock and roll songs from my long ago youth. And my guest today, James Lawler, was indeed a secret agent man for the CIA. In fact, Lawler is kind of a legendary secret agent man for cobbling together an operation that brought down the nuclear weapons smuggling ring run by the notorious Pakistani scientist AQ Khan. Since then, Jim Lawler has become a successful spy novelist with his first two thrillers nested in his intelligence work disrupting WMD networks. In the Twinkling of an Eye, a novel of biological terror and espionage, and Living Lies, a novel of the Iranian nuclear weapons program. He's working on a third. What distinguishes Lawler's books is their authoritative focus on the key moments when his heroes actually recruit someone to spy for the United States, something that Lawler did many times himself in his CIA career. The often tricky, tedious, and yet fraught process is what we're going to talk about today. In effect, we're going to offer what amounts to a mini tutorial on what a CIA officer actually does when he or she is handed an espionage mission. Usually, it's a painstaking process that's nothing like you see in the spy movies. And so, without further ado, Jim Lawler, welcome to Spy Talk. What a great opportunity it is for us to talk about spying. You are legendary within the CIA, where you spent decades for your various operations, in particular busting up the AQ Khan nuclear smuggling network. But as we talked earlier, I want to talk about, for the great unwashed, let's say, how this actually works. I think people are really misled by movies and so on. About how the process works of actually getting someone to spy for us. And I might say this applies to the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, anyone worthy of a spy apparatus uses these same methods to one degree or another with different national characteristics. But everybody uses basically the same techniques. So let's start with the mission. Let's say the mission you're handed, and the agency is handed, is to find out everything they can about the biological weapons programs in Russia.
Okay.
How do you start?
The way we do it today is really different from the way we did it maybe 25 years ago. Now we have a whole cadre of officers known as targeting officers. And they have not only substantial knowledge about how biological weapons work, they also have all source information on suspect facilities, let's say in Russia, that may be the producers of biological weapons. And they look at that, they look at the human intelligence, the human, they look at the signals intelligence, they look at the cyber intelligence, they look at the overhead, and they see, is this facility one that could in fact produce biological weapons, not countermeasures, but biological mm-hmm. weapons. And then they'll do a wiring diagram of all the people that we know who might work there. And they may check people that are in the benign institutes, the non-BW-related institutes, but who have colleagues that work there. And then they will look and see, okay, of all these scientists or the officials that work there, how many of these people go to scientific conferences abroad? Because we're not going to go into Russia and try and bump or meet a Russian scientist because of the extreme counterintelligence measures that the FSB, the Russian Internal Service, Domestic Service, would be deploying around a biological weapons facility. It could be FSB.
Or anywhere inside Russia.
Right. It's just too high of a counterintelligence risk. I mean, we've got now several Americans who've been arrested on spurious charges of espionage. And you can imagine if someone like myself or one of my colleagues who's genuinely going to be guilty of espionage, I mean, they would throw us into Siberia and throw away the key. So that's not going to happen. So we see exactly when do these people go abroad? You know, fortunately, they frequently do have to go abroad to attend scientific conferences or trade shows or to acquire some maybe esoteric equipment. And that's when we would like to know, if I'm a case officer and I'm targeting these people, I want to know, okay, when and where are they going? Do they have a pattern where they go? What do we know about these people? Have they ever met an American before?
Right. So the scene is set. Now let's talk about a term that you mentioned in passing, the bump. The bump, meaning to bump into one of these officials.
Right. It's where you have some kind of hopefully good cover and you're at this conference or trade show. And you kind of innocently sidle up to this person. First, you're checking to see if that person has what we call minders or babysitters from the security service around them. And that presents a challenge because a lot of times they are accompanied by minders. But if you can figure out a way to get them apart from the minder and then innocently go up and strike up a conversation, and what you're looking for in that particular bump, that meeting, that little initial contact is a follow-up meeting away from their colleagues, away from things. So you have to come up with a plausible reason why you would want to meet me at the cafe. It could be something totally oblique, totally innocent, but something that would intrigue them. Let's say I need speakers for another conference going on, and we have a very handsome honorarium that we give to our speakers. And so we would say, could we discuss you coming and being a keynote speaker at a conference?
Well, let's back up a little bit. Let's talk about the cover mm-hmm. that you mentioned. As everyone knows, the U.S. and other great powers with significant intelligence operations use diplomatic cover. People pose as diplomats or even very low-level diplomats, maybe a clerk mm-hmm. at an embassy who would not draw attention. That's the cover that they use. But there's all sorts of covers. Again, we're talking to people who may not have thought much about how this actually works. So there's covers, there's civilian covers, and under what we call non-official cover. In other words, you might represent yourself as a scientist. That would be a very logical approach to a Russian scientist. You may represent yourself as an American businessman or a Canadian businessman or a French right, businessman right. for that That's, matter.
I mean, we do that. I mean, we could do a false flag thing where we're foreign documented. But let me go back to one thing you said, Jeff. One thing I've always mm-hmm. told my students that I teach approach techniques and human intelligence to is if you're not a scientist, don't pretend to be a scientist, because that other scientist, that your cover will dissolve in about 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
So you have to come up with something creative that is not the scientist. Maybe you're the person, in my case, I'm an attorney. So maybe my specialty is intellectual property rights, and maybe I'm involved in a legal case and I need an expert witness to come and testify for my client. And it so happens that the target happens to have expertise in that area. And by the way, we pay expert witnesses as much as $1,500, $2,000 a day for their testimony.
Very inviting.
Very inviting, very innocent. And this type of thing goes on all the time. And since most cases, legal cases, never go to trial, they're somehow settled in litigation, you know, but we want the strong testimony of an expert witness. So I might approach a scientist with a proposition: would you consent to come to my hotel room? I've got this problem that I have. And I'd have some real scientist back home at CIA or somebody draw up a problem that this scientist could conceivably help us on. And they would make some easy money by giving me some answers to this litigation issue that we've got.
But that's pretty aggressive. I mean, aren't you sort of outing yourself as a CIA officer?
No, not necessarily. This would be at the second meeting. I would say, well, I'm here looking for expertise. I'm here at this conference, and I'm looking for experts in this particular area of, say, gene splicing. Oh, you're into gene splicing. Yeah, okay, well.
Well, let's talk about the first meeting. So first of all, let's say this person has minders, Russian intelligence officers around him. How do you get them away from that? And we don't need to go deeply into that. But let's go to that first meeting. You've got a guy, he's going to go have a cup of coffee with you. He's going to have a drink with you, whatever. So you got to be really careful at this point of not exposing yourself as an intelligence officer. Do you make it up as you go along, assessing the reaction of the person?
No. Well, sometimes, yes, sometimes you're doing this on the fly, but ordinarily you've got some cover that you can defend something that, you know, again, I can't pretend to be a scientist. But because I have a legal background, I could be the special counsel to some American pharmaceutical company that needs some expertise. And what we would have done, we would have studied in any international journals anything that this scientist has ever published. And if they have published things, then I would have one of our American scientists explain to me what this means in lay language and in how I can craft an approach to this person. Cite the fact that we've read his articles in these journals and that we value them very highly. And of course, that's very flattering. And so then we would slide into, would you mind having breakfast with me? Now, you asked, how do I get him apart from the minders? And that can be tricky. So if I'm working in a team, I might have some of my colleagues basically obstruct what I'm doing, separate out him from the minders, maybe engage the minders. And as one of my colleagues once said, don't ignore the fact that the minder may be a good target himself.
Ah,
so
exactly.
Right. And if he's an intelligence officer, you can quickly get down to business with this guy, maybe even a cold pitch.
So a cold pitch, explain that.
Okay, I'm sorry. A cold pitch is where I am reasonably sure or even confident that a target has access to classified or sensitive information, but I have personally never met this person before. Now, we may have book on them. We may have a file on them saying that this guy has been in signals intelligence. We know that he's going through a bad divorce. We know that he hates his boss. The more ammunition I have like that, when I approach this person, and all I want to do is, I don't want to recruit them in this. Sure, I'd love to recruit them, but I'm not going to recruit them on the first approach. I'm going to try and get them away from, again, the minders, away from the conference, and talk to them and say, you know, I've got an offer for you, and here's what it is. But again, a cold pitch, you know, the warmer the cold pitch can be, meaning the more that we know about the target, it ups my chances of a recruitment. Cold pitches have kind of a bad reputation because they're so frequently poorly done, or they're done in a matter of desperation. When I say desperation, you've got people at CIA headquarters or DIA headquarters, and we've been batting terribly against, say, the Iranians. And so some manager comes up with this bright idea. Let's go out and just cold pitch these people. Those type of numbskull operations don't work very frequently.
I just rewatched last night a movie that deals exactly with that. I think it's called Body of Lies, based on the David Ignatius spy novel, in which an overbearing CIA manager keeps pushing his agent, played by a Hollywood star whose name I suddenly can't remember, pushing his agent to take much more aggressive steps, and he ends up pissing off the local Jordanian spy chief who's an ally. So this happens. A clumsy approach can really blow up in your face, and you don't get a second chance.
Absolutely. Not only does it blow up, it's an embarrassment, and it basically turns off the guy you just pitched, because he feels like, if you're that irresponsible and unprofessional, I would never work for you. The whole thing about recruiting somebody is you want them to be, you want to get their confidence, and you want to build that foundation of trust. And if you do this in some really half-assed method of doing stuff, they'll think, not only do I not want to ever work for the CIA, I never want to even be close to you.
And you do this step by step by step in the normal procedure. You're not doing cold pitches every day. That wouldn't work very well. So
No, not often. I mean, I've done several and had luck with them. I've been fortunate, had good luck with them, but they're kind of I started to say a last resort. In some respects it is. Let's say you've got a visiting, again, we'll go back to a Russian biological weapons scientist, we suspect, and he's only going to be in town for maybe 24 hours, 48 hours. And you've got, he comes out once a year, maybe, then this is probably the time when maybe a cold pitch is the only chance you've got. Because clearly any other type of pitch other than a cold pitch would be much preferred. But you've got one shot. You know, it's a Hail Mary pass.
Got it.
And so you've got to basically go in and do it. And what I tell my students, because I teach these techniques, is practice against a colleague. Have the colleague hit you back, spar with you verbally, every objection they can come up with. I know the most momentous cold pitch I ever did was one where I had to pitch a guy in a nuclear network, and I practiced against one of my friends. We were both runners, and we'd go running several miles, and I would pitch, and I'd pitch, and I'd pitch, and he'd counter and counter. And when I finally got down to the real cold pitch, it was much easier than pitching my friend. So practicing is essential, in my opinion, to do it. Don't be embarrassed to ask a friend or a colleague if you can practice.
And in fact, the training is much about that. As you know, I went through HUMIT training in the Army many years ago, which parallels CIA training to a great extent. And we would have classroom exercises where an instructor would act as a potential target of recruitment. And you would sit down at this, makeup cafe and start having a conversation and practicing your approach. And to cut to the chase here, one of the cardinal aspects of the recruitment pitch was that you should get the target to a point where he knows he almost has recruited themselves. So by the time you finally ask, do the big ask, and not a lot of case officers, as you know, can do this. They get stage fright. They cannot make that final pitch. They can't close the deal.
Right.
But in the ideal situation, you're assessing someone as a potential spy. And through a number of meetings, which have increasing confidentiality, so the guy, the target, knows that there's something quite odd going on here. They know what's coming by the time you pitch them. So it's not a wild fling.
That's exactly right. In fact, we refer to that technique that you're describing as showing a little bit of thigh. you're dropping it just a bit to let them know that this is more than the ordinary. And in fact, you want to make them feel so special that they have been specially selected for this, that we don't talk to just anybody about this. And this is why I trust you, and I want you to trust me, that this is an opportunity that's fleeting, and it's one that only you can fulfill.
I love that, showing a little thigh, that, or a little ankle, as we used to say.
Whatever
you're showing. The person knows what's coming by the time you make the pitch in an ideal situation.
Almost always. In fact, sometimes what I would do is, in a meeting or two beforehand, I might drop a trial balloon. I might talk about something, you know, a hypothetical, which is really not a hypothetical at all, but let that plant that seed in there. I call that crack in the windshield that spider webs out. You know, when you're driving along and that you get that chip in the windshield, and then over time it spider webs out. Well, I want to plant that seed sometimes and then come back to it and then say, you know, I've been talking to my boss back home, and he thinks you would be ideal in this particular role. And you've already planted the seed. You've let them know that this would be to their advantage. You know a lot about them. You know that they're under stress. As I've said in some other talks that I give, I never once recruited a happy person. You recruit unhappy people, people who are under stress, people who need you, and you become what they need.
Well, let's talk about this, you know, sort of a legendary acronym about motivations of people to spy, usually reduced to MICE: money, ideology, compromise or coercion, and ego. And what this boils down to is someone hasn't gotten a promotion that they felt they were due. They have an overbearing boss, so they're resentful. They really need money. In the case of Aldrich Ames, the CIA turncoat, he had a wife who was used to a luxurious lifestyle, and he needed money. So he just walked into the Soviet embassy and said, "Here I am." So ideological spies, that's been a big chip that the CIA, United States, has had for a long time, especially during the Soviet period. People just got fed up with communism. And then there's compromise or coercion. In other words, we know that this person is already doing something illegal or dodgy that would get him in trouble with his own authorities. Right. And so we use that. And then there's ego, which is always in play. You want to make sure that the target, that you show how much you appreciate the target and build up their ego.
I'd say of those four elements, the most important one, in fact, is ego. The others are, to a lesser extent, important. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that money by itself is never a motivator. And I even have a talk where I give, it's called, "Are the Mice Dead?" Because basically money, and you know, people like the former head of East German intelligence, he said money's never the sole motivator. And I agree. That was Marcus Wolff. And he was a master spy master. I mean, I detest the communist system and the Stasi and all that. But let me tell you, Marcus Wolff was one brilliant spy. And he worked this, and he said, money's never the only thing. Now, did money play a role in all this stuff? Of course. People need money for various things. They've got a gambling habit. They've got a girlfriend. They're in trouble with somehow. They shorted their money box. They've wasted something, and they need money for something. But money by itself, hardly ever. It's, you know, even Tolkachev, who was arrested and shot in Russia, the billion-dollar spy, he had several, I think, thousands of dollars in his attic. But it was more of an ego. He never spent it. It was an ego thing, I think, with him. And so I would say that the other elements that you named, the ideology, the coercion, and the ego, those are the most important ones. We occasionally get somebody on ideology because they actually believe in the ideals of America, and they detest communism, or they detest the dictatorship that they're living in. And now they probably have subordinate motivations as well, because rarely do you recruit somebody on a single motivation. It's what I call a whole mosaic of motivations. But they probably want to pay some lip service to a noble reason, which is ideology. I believe in America. I believe in you. I want to be part of your team. And I used to try and get people, I want you as part of my team. You're not working for me. You're working with me. And get them highly motivated.
Many CIA officers have told me that the rampant corruption in Russia and China and Iran have also spurred opportunities for recruitment by us and other Western intelligence services. And, you know, that brings someone to us who may have been involved in high-level corruption themselves and wants to get wants a ticket out of jail by spying for us or bargaining that, please bring me to the United States, and I'll tell you everything. And, of course, that's where the next dance begins, where you say, well, you start giving us information first, and then we'll think about bringing you to the United States.
Right, because a commitment to bring somebody to the United States is very – you, the case officer, cannot promise that. That comes from the director of CIA. We have, I think, 100 slots a year under Public Law 110 that we can bring a source who into the United States along with their family. And we do that, but it's an extremely expensive proposition. And you have to get the director of CIA to basically agree to that. And then you offer that. I'll give you an example. Let's say we recruit a scientist in the Iranian nuclear weapons program. And we tell them, if you'll work inside, and we'll equip you with a covert communications device, if you work inside for us for 2 years, then we will bring you and your family out and we will settle you in the United States. We'll provide you housing. We'll find employment for you. We'll give you and your family language lessons if need be. And you can live in the West. You'll get your American citizenship.
Under a whole new name and identity.
Absolutely.
Witness protection.
Yeah, it's basically a witness relocation program for CIA. And we do that. But that requires the most senior authority to offer that. But that's highly attractive to a lot of sources.
Sure. I want to get out of the mess. So let's go to the next stage. So you've recruited someone, but you know, you can't be, you know, that's not it. They don't just start spying. You've got to test them, right? You have to find some way to test their loyalty, that they are, in fact, working for us.
Yes, we have a thing called the asset validation system. And so we have various ways to go about and test people. And I always say, if you want to test somebody, test them in the most meaningful area that you can. I mean, what if you're the case officer, what would keep you up at night about your asset if things were to go wrong? And so you design a test or an experience, something like that. I'll give you an unplanned test. I was handling a very sensitive asset overseas, and I had when I talk about sensitive, this was ultra sensitive. And he was assigned to this country, and he had a medical issue. Occasionally, he had to see a doctor. Well, I met him at a certain point, and he and I got in a taxi cab, and we're going to then take the cab and go to a safe house where I could have a full debriefing of this asset. As luck would have it, we're driving along the street, and suddenly he looks over and he sees this man about 15 feet from him. It's his ambassador, And so he's having a heart attack in the cab.
I bet.
And he says, oh my God, my ambassador. And so I quickly came up with a cover story. I said, well, I look very, you know, we were in a European country. I look very European. I'm your doctor. We had to go and get some special tests if he asks. But I wrote that up as a successful validation that this guy was not a double agent being run at us, because he was scared out of his mind by the fact that the ambassador might have seen him. It was almost like a Hitchcock movie. You remember in Psycho where they're driving along and she sees her boss? Well, this was the same thing. And so I wrote that up as a unplanned, unscheduled test.
But there are planned tests.
Oh, there are planned tests.
Where you give your new asset a mission, right. And there's ways to check on whether they carried it out in the way and came back with results that you were looking for.
Exactly. For a while there at CIA, I ran what I called an asset test unit, and we would actually test other people's assets for them. And, you know, again, I would ask, what's your greatest fear? And so then we would try and design a test that would address that greatest fear.
Such as, can you give me an example of that?
Okay. Yeah. All right. I was involved in a lot of counterproliferation operations, and we had to have assets that we could trust who would sell, let's say, sabotage goods to the enemy. But our nightmare was that they would sell pristine working goods to the enemy. I mean, that would be the sum of all fears, is they would take the equipment that's not been modified, that's not been sabotaged, and sell pristine equipment to, say, a certain country's nuclear weapons program. Go rogue and do that.
But this is after they've been recruited by you. And you feel that this is a strong asset, a controllable asset, right, whose loyal the recruitment process has been completed. But still?
Right. But again, if my biggest nightmare is this guy is making a lot of money for me, but suddenly he goes to the enemy and he says, how would you like to get this stuff that's not modified? And I will sell it to you for X amount.
So they reveal their hand that the CIA has recruited them, but they're kind of chickening out?
Well, that would be my fear. Yeah, that they would basically become a double agent, that they would betray us and then sell unmodified goods to this enemy nation. So what I did is I got a case officer who was ethnic, the same as the target nation. Mm-hmm. And I had him approach my asset and pitch the guy to basically, under the table, sell them stuff. Well, fortunately, in every case, my asset came back and said, oh my God, you know what happened is I've been approached by people from this country and they want me to sell this stuff to them. And of course, I know what went on the other side because the person who pitched him was actually an undercover CIA officer. Mm-hmm. So I've got the test and I've got the fact that he reported truthfully and accurately what happened. So to me, that is the test of all tests, is this guy's good. He's faithful to us. He will tell us if something improper is going on. And we did that on a number of occasions, and it worked well.
Very clever to me. That sounds like a good test. So let's talk about another aspect of the spying game, common to all intelligence services, which is a commo plan, as we call it. How we're going to communicate with these agents once they're back behind enemy lines, they're back in Moscow or Tehran or Beijing, wherever they are. Now, you've got to communicate with this person. And that becomes the riskiest part of the operation, the area in which you know that the hostile intelligence services are always looking to see what CIA is up to in their country. And so you've got to develop a plan. Now, we all know about dead drops, where you conceal something. One classic example was, we would conceal messages in what looked like a dead rat in an alley. Tell us about the difficulty of establishing communications plans and the incredible surveillance and counter-surveillance that's needed to keep this agent safe.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head, Jeff. The weakest part of any intelligence operation is communications. And if you look at a lot of the cases from CIA or FBI that have gone bad, frequently, a huge amount of the time, it goes back to a faulty or compromised communications plan.
We know of two examples of that, or reported examples of that, in which a CIA agent network in Iran was compromised by a faulty communication, a leak of the communications. And the same in China, where it has been reported that a wide network of CIA spies, which I suppose is the upside that we even had in a wide network of spies in China, were rolled up because of a communication weakness. This really does happen.
It happens, sadly, it does. And there's a number of reasons why this happens. Again, it's the weakest part of any kind of operation, but it's the essential part, because if you can't communicate with your asset, there's no operation. You recruited this person to give you information, but if he or she can't communicate with you, then what's the point? But you're right. And sometimes if you go back and you look at some of the operations that went under because of a communications problem, frequently it could be that we've overused a certain system or we have overused a certain communications method because it's inexpensive or it's less expensive if you have multiple people on the same thing. But if you don't single wire, you know, don't make a unique communications plan with each asset, then that means if they discover one part of the network, they can then systematically, like dominoes, you know, reveal the other parts of the network. And that's what sometimes happens is, in fact, it comes down, if you want to get down to communication, it comes down to a lack of communications between the case officers and the people, the technicians who are designing these things. Mm-hmm. Sometimes. Now, you could also have a bad asset on our side, meaning a bad CIA officer. I think in one of the cases that you mentioned, I think there may have been a bad CIA officer who then tipped off the adversary nation. It could have been China. I'm not going to confirm or not deny that, but could have said, you know, you need to look at this. And then suddenly they start rolling that up because they had a spy within our ranks, mm-hmm. who's basically tipping them off as to the type of communications method that we're using.
It's an interesting fact of the espionage game or the history of espionage that one of the ways that Al-Qaeda was successful and ISIS and so on is that they recognized the technological superiority of the U.S. in particular communications intercept methods. And so they stayed off their cell phones. And we've seen rather recently that the Hezbollah leader, Nasrallah, has told very publicly his people to stay off their cell phones because the U.S. is listening. We know
this is common knowledge. I recruited a very senior Middle Eastern asset, and we were going to try and do something. He said, look, whenever I need to talk to somebody, I get on an airplane and I go and I talk to them in person. And mm-hmm. I mean, this was 25, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he was ultra, you know, secure by just waiting until he could actually get somewhere and then talk to that person.
And we know that the Cubans use the old fashioned shortwave radio to communicate with its undercover spies, one in the State Department, one in the Defense Intelligence Agency, Ana Montes. She would listen on a shortwave radio broadcast of numbers that she knew that she could then translate into messages of instructions, right. and so on. Now, another aspect is not unimportant. Money. It comes into play in a lot of these operations. How do you pay someone when they're in a sensitive position, and any increase in their lifestyle, a new car or whatever, would draw suspicion?
Well, you need to keep them under control, not let them go hog wild and buy a fancy new car when nobody else in their village or their organization has such a car, or to be spending lavishly. And sometimes we pay them in different ways. I remember on one of my first tours, I was tasked to go to a very, very high-end stamp collecting shop and buy some specific, very rare stamps that our asset behind the Iron Curtain wanted to have. And the beauty of this is these things were worth thousands and thousands of dollars. I mean, I went into this shop with a stack of bills like you wouldn't believe, and I was buying certain rare stamps, and then we would be able to just mail these stamps to this guy. And if the security office were to find them, they just find all these stamps. Well,
beautiful.
They didn't know.
I love it.
It was gorgeous. It was gorgeous.
I love it. Can you think of another one?
Yes, I can. A good friend of mine, he was handling a very sensitive, I think it was a code clerk. A code clerk is the cipher clerk, the person that is in charge of the communications, the very sensitive encrypted communications. And this particular asset, he wanted to be paid in diamonds. So my friend goes out to meet the asset, and he's got a bag of diamonds to pay this guy. And so he hands it to the asset, and the asset drops the bag, and the diamonds go all over the ground.
Oh, my.
And so my friend and this very sensitive asset from this Iron Curtain country are down on their hands and knees trying to find all the diamonds.
Well, That didn't work out too well. No. Finally, Jim, I think I first met you when you gave this very entertaining lecture at a conference, which I think was entitled, I Was a Sociopath for the CIA. Give us the essence of that talk.
Well, it's a little bit of hyperbole. My psychiatrist friends, and I have several, you might say, yeah, Jim, you need a psychiatrist. They assure me that I'm not a classic sociopath, but I'm the kind of person that I'm rarely deterred from getting my way, that when I go after somebody, I'm coming after you. You know, you and I are going to be best buddies. We're going to be best friends. And so there is a certain amount of sociopathy that is dialed into a case officer. And
meaning you're manipulating people.
Manipulate. Yes, I manipulate people. I exploit people. I subvert, I suborn. I convince them to commit espionage, to commit treason, to betray a trust. And that is a certain amount of sociopathy. And also, I enjoy it. This is really sociopathic.
Happy warrior.
Absolutely. I mean, I really enjoy, you know, manipulating these people and getting them to do what I want. I gave a talk similar to the one you heard, Jeff, out at NSA a few years ago on their Counterintelligence and Security Awareness Day. And I went through all these stories of how I recruited foreign spies, meaning that the 500 or 600 NSA employees, if somebody like me is coming after you, here's the type of techniques I would use. At the end of this talk, a young man in the back of the audience, he raised his hand and he asked me, Mr. Lawler, do you consider yourself to be a moral person?
Hmm.
And I said, you know, that's an excellent question. I've thought about that a lot. And I said, I've come to the conclusion that if a young Marine Corps sniper takes an Al-Qaeda bomb maker into his sights at 1,000 yards, he's a moral person. And I said, if I do the type of things I do where I recruit spies, if I do it for national security reasons, I feel like I'm a moral person as well. But where it becomes immoral is how much I enjoy it. So
very funny, very entertaining. So this takes me back to my first day in spy school in the Army in 1967. That's how old I am. Anyway, the lecturer said, the instructor said, for those of you who are still clueless about what this is all about, we're going to tell you what this course is all about, what you've been selected into. And some of you may find what we're going to ask you to do is immoral, unethical, against all their values. And after we explain what this course is about, which is espionage and learning how to do espionage, this is the only thing in the Army that you can raise your hand at the end and say, you know, I've changed my mind. This isn't for me. And so they went through exactly what we've been talking about today, how you manipulate, for lack of a better word, people into spying for the United States. And at the end, one guy raised his hand and he said, this is not for me. So he walked out. And I ran into him a couple of weeks later and I said, so where are you going now? And he said, I'm going to missile school, ICBMs. I said, well, that certainly had a moral superiority to it. Anyway, this is very, very entertaining, Jim, and very instructive, I hope, for a lot of people who'd like to know more about how this game, as we call it, is played. Thanks for coming on the show and talking about it.
It's always a pleasure, Jeff. Thank you for having me on.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the SpyTalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai, and edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.